continue in our study of 1 Samuel with chapter 12 and verse 10. We are actually beginning a study in the middle of a message. The message is being delivered by Samuel. And so let me review what we have covered in the first 9 verses very quickly, and then we'll pick it up with verse 10. Before I do that, however, I'm reminded that I was asked a question last week that I do not have an answer for, or did not have an answer for, and that is, who became the high priest following the time of Eli? We know in Scripture that the priesthood of Eli ended with him. His sons also died in battle about the same time that he died, himself having learned of the death of his sons. And there is no place that I can find that there is a definitive answer as to who actually functioned in this capacity. The two likely prospects of who might have served in this capacity would be Samuel himself and Zadok. Now, other people may have some guesses, but the scriptures just are not really clear at this point. I'm of the opinion, in light of what we've been studying and are studying, that Samuel probably served in the function of both prophet, judge, and priest during his kind of a buffer ministry. He was the last of the judges and was the one that God selected to be the one who anointed the first king. So during the time of Samuel, the first king will come to power, and during his reign, Samuel will also anoint the next king when the next king is still a child. But he will become the king following the death of King Saul. So that's the best I can do for you in answer to that question. Looking over the first 9 verses of this chapter, Samuel is presenting a message to the people. In this message, he is challenging them to find anything that was wrong with his service as a judge. And when he became quite detailed and said, have I done this or have I done that that was wrong, the people all agreed, no, you've not done anything wrong. You've been a good judge. And he then wanted to say that, all right, and the Lord has witnessed to what you have said, and he agreed with them. So he wanted to make sure that the course of history, as it's going to take its turn now, would not be blamed on him. Samuel does not look forward to the future with very much optimism, because he sees the people having made a very serious mistake in deciding that they want a king. And so he is reminding them of the fact that they're about to have the man serving them that is exactly what they have requested and God is permitting them to have. But it's not something that Samuel is comfortable with, and it's not something that really is honoring God. So he then points out to them, let me remind you of some of your history. Let's go back to the time that God's people were slaves in the land of Egypt. Here they are, slavery, dominated by a superpower. Is there any way that they can ever get out of this? Well, they did. Why? Because they called out to God. Is God somebody that has the power to deliver them? Well, he did. He made arrangements for Moses and Aaron, his brother, to come and to lead them out of Egypt and lead them on their way to the promised land. So then he skips over and comes to the time that they're in the promised land. He said, have the people of God encountered any opposition while they've been in the process of conquering the land of Canaan? Well, yes, they have. Has God given victory in these occasions? And so he mentions a few of them by name, and they have to all agree, yes, God has provided the victory. And when God has provided victories through such men as Gideon and Jephthah and others. Obviously, God has proved his great power because they served against forces that outnumbered them. Particularly, that was true in the case of Gideon. But so that's where we are in the message that he's delivering to them. So in verse 10, after having called attention to Eglon, the king of Moab, and Sisera, the commander-in-chief of the Canaanite king, he now is in verse 10 saying, "They cried out to the Lord and said, 'We have sinned because we have forsaken the Lord and have served Baals and the Asherah. But now deliver us from the hands of our enemies, and we will serve you.'" So the question is, did Israel admit their sins when the Lord punished them by giving them into the hands of their enemies? Yes, he did. Now, what are the Baals and the Ashtoreth that is referred to in this verse? All right, these are the pagan gods and goddesses. The Baals would be the male gods, and the Ashtoreth would be the female goddesses. What promise did Israel make when they confessed their sins? All right, when the people confessed their sins, the way in which they showed their genuineness of their confession is that they would promise then to be faithful to God if he would give them security against their enemy. I'm sorry?
Did they pass down their idols, killed them? Got rid of the idols.
Okay, that's true. All right, verse 11, please.
"And the Lord sent Jerubbaal and Bedan and Jephthah and Samuel and delivered you out of the hand of your enemies on every side, and ye dwell safe."
All right, so what did God do when Israel repented of their idolatry and promised to serve him? He'd raise up another leader, wouldn't he? And he mentioned some of these leaders that he raised up as judges that would give them victory over their enemy. By what other name do we know Jerubbaal? You better know him by a different name. Gideon, right. He's the one that delivered the Israel from the Midianite opposition. And who was Bedan? This is probably a reference to Barak. And Barak is the one who served with what judge?
Deborah.
There is no other name like this in the book of Judges. And that's why most people think this is just another spelling for what we better know, or the one we better know as Barak. Now, who was Jephthah? What was his occupation? He was a judge. At least he was called to be a judge at the time we best remember him. He's the one, you remember, that made the rash promise, indicating that if God would give them victory, he would then give to God the first thing that came out of his home, which happened to be his daughter. But he was very effective as a military leader for the people. Did Samuel hesitate to include himself in the list of judges?
No,
no, he did not. Speaking very honestly here. All right. Continuing on then in verse 12. "When you saw that Nahash, the king of the sons of Ammon, came against you, you said to me, 'No, but a king shall reign over us, although the Lord your God was your king.'" Now, is Samuel implying that the people doubted God's ability to care for them by their insisting upon having a king? Seems to me that that's what he's doing. Does the call for a king suggest a weakening of Israel's faith in God?
Yes.
Yes, it does. Now, what is clarified in this verse? In other words, we're learning something here that we had not been made aware of before. Well, the thing you may not have picked up on this, but this rise of the Ammonite threat is really behind their insistence upon having a king. Now, we were not made aware of that in previous verses, previous chapters, when they came and requested a king like other nations have. But here we're learning that at the time that they're requesting a king, apparently they are running scared and afraid that God just might not give them victory over the Ammonites who lived on the east side of the Jordan River. Verse 13, please.
Now therefore, here is the king whom you have chosen, whom you have asked for, and behold, the Lord has set a king over you.
All right, so what three steps are outlined here that have led to the present situation? What's the first step? All right, they had chosen this king, referring to what had just taken place at Gilgal. That's where he was publicly announced to all the people and accepted by all the people as their king. And what's the second step that was taken?
They'd asked for one.
That's right, they'd asked for this king before he actually became the king. And then the final step was what? Yeah, God has honored your request and has set a king over you. Now, sometimes little words can have a real important meaning. I think that may be the significance of the word behold in this particular verse. I think it emphasizes that this development was unexpected in view of the fact that the request for the people had been an act of hostility to God. This was not really what God wanted for the people, but God had done it. So he says, and behold, I want you to realize, even though this is not something I wanted and something that I'm sure that God is not happy with, yet God has done as you've requested him to do in giving you a king. All right, now verse 14, please.
We will fear the Lord and serve him and listen to his voice and not rebel against the command of the Lord. Then both you and also the king who reigns over you will follow the Lord's heart.
All right, does Samuel sound a positive note here in his address?
Yes,
he does. Now, what are the conditions for prosperity under kings? First of all, the condition would be what?
Fear the Lord.
All right, what does it mean to fear the Lord?
Revere.
All right, to have respect for him. Fear is one of those words with double meanings, depending upon the context. Sometimes it means to be afraid. Sometimes it means to have respect. Obviously here, it means to have respect. And if you don't have respect for him, then you've got a good reason to be afraid of him. All right, what's the second condition?
Serve
him. All right, they must serve the Lord. If you expect God to be with you and bless you, you obviously must serve him. What's the third condition?
Listen to him.
You have to listen to his voice. That's right. The fourth condition.
Not rebel.
All right. You have to obey what he tells you to do, not rebel against him. And then the final condition is? You must follow the Lord your God. So these five conditions are the way in which they can expect to have good days ahead in their time of kings if they will honor God in these five different ways. Verse 15, please.
You will not listen to the voice of the Lord, but rebel against the command of the Lord. Then the hand of the Lord will be against you, that was against your father.
All right, does Samuel make clear what the alternatives for Israel are?
Yes.
In other words, you serve the Lord or you're going to suffer the consequences. Now, what is the hand of the Lord? I think it refers to his power, which involves his ability and authority to bring judgment upon a people that are not faithful to him. All right, would you read verses 16 and 17, please?
Now take your stand and see this great thing which the Lord will do before your eyes. Is it not the wheat harvest? Is it not the wheat harvest today? I will call to the Lord, and he may send thunder and rain. Then you will know and see that your wickedness is great, which you have done in the sight of the Lord by asking for yourselves a king.
Kind of sounds like Samuel is going to make sure that everyone really recognizes that he's not in favor of anything that's happened. And the people are going to have to accept the responsibility for what is about to happen. He wants to make that very clear. And of course, Samuel knows what he's talking about. He's speaking as a prophet of God. We must not forget that. So there are four things that Samuel calls for the people to do. What's the first thing?
Take your stand.
That's right. What's the second thing?
Watch what the Lord's going to do.
All right, watch what the Lord's going to do, because he's going to do something that's you're not going to expect, but it's going to happen because I said it's going to happen. What's the third thing? Well, he indicates what the results are going to be by what happens here. And then the final thing, he explains the purpose of this miraculous demonstration. Are miracles ever used in the Bible to prove that the man is speaking God's truth, or to prove that the man who is speaking is God's man?
Yes.
Every time. Yes. Every time. That's the purpose of miracles. This is, we're going to see one here. Is Samuel determined to drive home the lesson he is teaching them?
Yes.
Yes, and that's why he's called upon the Lord for this miraculous proof of the words that he's been speaking to them.
Was the time of wheat harvest a time that had no rain?
Generally speaking, it's a dry season, month of June.
So this will be very
unusual. Yeah, it wouldn't have been much of a sign if it weren't unusual. Yeah. That's exactly right. So Samuel called to the Lord, and the Lord sent thunder and rain that day, and all the people greatly feared the Lord and Samuel. Now, had Samuel made an accurate prediction?
Yes.
Yes, he had. Which, by the way, does what for Samuel?
Show that he is a man of God.
That's exactly right. Were the people afraid of God, or did they respect God?
They were probably afraid of him more than
they were. If they respect him, they wouldn't want a king.
Kind of a mixture here, isn't it? They stood in awe and amazement to see what happened. It was something he couldn't deny. Did the people respond to God and Samuel in the same way?
Yeah, they put them on the scene.
Yes, they did. Now, what did this miracle show?
Well, that if you don't obey, I will come and make your day short.
All right, and it certainly demonstrates God's power, doesn't it? God's doing something that was unusual at this particular time, but it's something within the ability of God. It shows that Samuel, obviously, was a prophet of God, was close to God, and therefore would be able to speak this way to them. Verse 19, please.
And all the people said to Samuel, "Wait for your servant to the Lord your God, so that we may not die. For we have added to all this evil by asking for ourselves a king."
Okay, so what sin is confessed by the people at this time? Yeah, they're finally admitting, we were wrong, we should not have asked for a king. Did the people understand what Samuel had been saying to them?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Did the people admit any other sins than that of asking for a king?
Yeah,
there's a bunch of sins that they're confessing here. Was any effort made to excuse the people or to lessen the extent of their guilt?
No.
Not at all. Since the people had previously acknowledged the innocence of Samuel, that's back in verses 4 and 5, are they seeing themselves in contrast to him?
Yes.
Oh, they certainly are that. All right. Verses 20 and 21, please.
Samuel said to the people, "Do not fear. You have committed all this evil, yet do not turn aside from following the Lord, but serve the Lord with all your heart. You must not turn aside, for then you would go after futile things which cannot profit or deliver because they are futile."
Does Samuel offer any hope for the people?
Yes.
Yes, he does. Their sins were in the past. Let's make sure they're not continuing. Now, what are futile things?
Idols.
Yes, anything that stands between a man and God. Anything that is an attempt to replace God. Obviously, idols fit that category. Verse 22, please.
"For the Lord will not abandon his people on account of his great name, because the Lord has been pleased to make you a people for himself."
Is God's reputation wrapped up in his people?
Yes.
Yes, it is. By the way, is that true today?
Yes.
Yes, it is. Does that make us see how serious our behavior is at all times, in all situations? Certainly ought to. Did the nations know that Israel was God's holy nation?
Yeah, they knew, yes, they still tested God.
Do the people today know that Christians are God's people?
Yes.
Sure do. What would the Gentiles think of God if God abandoned Israel?
Not very much.
That's putting it mildly. That's true. Now, is the past, in the past, had Israel taken advantage of the fact that they were God's people? Every time they rebelled against him. That's exactly right. Verse 23, please.
Moreover, as for me, far be it from me that I should sin against the Lord by ceasing to pray for you, but I would instruct you in the good and right way.
You need to draw a circle around this verse. You need to remember this verse. This is a very important verse. Is it a sin not to pray for others?
Yes.
That's the point that this verse is making very clear. I'm afraid that all of us are guilty from time to time of not praying for some people that really need our prayers. Did Samuel harbor resentment in his heart?
No.
No, he didn't. Even though Samuel is disappointed in that the people rejected both himself and God, does he still desire the best for the welfare of Israel?
Yes.
Yes, he does. Will Samuel do what he can to answer his prayer on behalf of the people?
Yes.
Yes, he will. He will give them instruction and guidance and encourage them in every way possible. Verses 24 and 25.
Only fear the Lord and serve him in truth with all your heart. For consider what great things he has done for you. But if you still do wickedly, both you and your king will be swept away.
What has happened that should cause the people to fear the Lord and serve him as Samuel calls on them to do?
They will be annihilated.
Yeah, they need to consider the great things that he has done for them. Have you observed both in the New Testament as well as already we've observed tonight here in the Old Testament, how many times those who are preaching the message of God make reference to what God's already done in the past?
Yes.
Again and again, you hear about Moses.
Yes.
You hear about all the victories that God has given his people and has protected his people in the time past. In the New Testament, 7th chapter of Acts, we have the sermon of Stephen. And he just simply gives them a history lesson. Do you realize who God is? Do you know what God has done for his people? And the Apostle Paul in his writings is constantly making reference to the Old Testament. Is there any validity in our reminding people of what God did in the Old Testament days?
We have short memories even today.
Yeah.
I preached a sermon last Lord's Day from the 12th chapter of Hebrews, where two verses make a passing reference to Esau and his disregard for the importance of his birthright and for the fact that he did not get the blessing. And I thought to myself as I was working on that sermon, how many people in my congregation will understand what those two verses are talking about? Now, the thing that I have to keep reminding myself, and I don't do a very good job of this, I grew up in a Christian home. My dad was a preacher, and I just can't remember not being around Christian people. I was preached to 7 days a week because of who my dad was. But to this day I can still visualize the classroom that I first attended when I was old enough to have any kind of memory and could listen and understand a story that was told to me. Plastered on the walls, every wall around that little room in the basement of our church building were Bible pictures. And when the teacher would tell a story, they'd say, "Now look at this picture because this is what we're going to talk about today. On another occasion, we'll look at this picture because this is what we're going to talk about today." And a lot of use was made of those pictures. But a number of years ago, a girl was in my freshman class at Bible College, and she came up to me after class and said, "Who's Samson?" And I thought, okay, I'm glad to answer that question. I said, "You've never heard of him?" She said, "No." I said, "I didn't even know about God until a month ago." And here she was in Bible College. I realized from that point on, everything I said, she wasn't going to understand unless I really explained it very well. number of years ago, I was called upon to hold a revival meeting at the Christian Church in St. Peter's, Missouri. And when I arrived on Sunday morning, the preacher greeted me with this statement: "I think it might help you to know that there is nobody in this church who's been a Christian more than 6 years. Nobody, except my wife and me." I said, "Thank you. I needed to know that." You know, there's some places where you can just make a passing reference to Abraham. They know exactly who you're talking about. The other places, who's he? They have no idea at all who that is. So it's important for us to rehearse Bible history, both Old Testament and New Testament, and tell the story again so that people will understand what is being said when reference is made. So what he's saying is, consider the great things that he's done for you. Samuel is calling attention to their own past. Now, what warning does Samuel give to the people? That's right. If you don't pay attention now and learn the lessons that history teaches you in God's dealing with man, you will suffer the consequences. Now, the purpose of chapters 13, 14, 15 is to help us to understand the deterioration that takes place during the time of the reign of King Saul. And so we're going to see now what happens in this beginning part of his reign, and get kind of an overview of Saul's experiences as king. So first of all, we're introduced to the war that they are going to have to fight with the Philistines. Would you read verse 1, please?
Saul was 30 years old when he began to reign, and reigned 42 years of people.
Okay, what problems confront us in this verse when comparing one version with another? When you, and by the way, I think this is good for anybody, if you can afford it, to have more than one version of the Bible if you don't know the Greek and the Hebrew language. If you don't have a lot of other books to help you out, just at least compare what's the difference between the King James Version, the New American Standard Version, and the NIV, and Good News for Modern Man, and others. Because many times you'll see that there is a difference. Now, if each one is the Bible, and yet they differ from one another, even in regard to some of their facts, then what's that saying to us? Can you trust the Bible? I sure hope so. But let me tell you something. How many versions of the Bible have come into being in your lifetime? Have there not been several? Now, who do you think is responsible for these? People. Do people ever make mistakes? Any of you who have ever been involved in bilingual work at all will recognize that when you translate from one language to another, sometimes you struggle to find out which is the best word to say what you want to have said. A few years ago, when I was in Haiti, I was teaching a book in the Bible, and I had two translators. I was so glad that I did, because there were occasions when they would debate with themselves, now what is the best word in Creole to say what he just said to us in English? They both understood me, but they wanted to make the fellows that were there in the class that didn't understand English understand it correctly, and I appreciate that. On a previous occasion, in another mission in Haiti, I was preaching a sermon, and I was interrupted in the middle of my sermon because someone in the audience said to my interpreter, "That's not what he said." And the interpreter said, "Yeah, that is what he said." And they said, "No, it isn't." And I thought, okay, let me say it again. And so I said it again, and my interpreter said, "Oh, I misunderstood what you said." It's kind of nice to have more than one interpreter, you know. So what am I saying? Do people make mistakes? Yes. And, you know, punctuation is different. Word choice is different. And sometimes it's a real challenge to know just exactly the precise way to word that. Well, that apparently is the case here. For an example, When Saul's length of reigning as king is recorded in the New Testament, what number of years is given?
40.
And here we read 42. Now, sometimes when we want to relate something, do we round it off? Yeah, we do.
It could be parts of 42 years.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
4 years, and then 2 months before, 4 months after, you're parts of 42 years.
I can't cite you just now offhand, but in the Gospels, there's an interesting relationship between the way the different Gospel writers record one of the events of Christ. One will say 6 days later, the other say 8 days. Yes. And they're doing exactly what you've just said. The 8 days indicating they're counting the beginning day and the last day, not just the ones in between, whereas the other one's counting the one in between. So this is one of the problems we have here with the numbers that are used in this verse. I just wanted to call that to your attention. I don't want you to be disturbed in reading the various versions. It's not that big a deal, but when you're a student, you need to know these things, and we need to not let them upset us when there's certainly a plausible explanation for it.
Yeah, no language can be translated word for word without language. It's just only one.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I have a hard time understanding people from up north.
If any of you people are visiting up north, keep your mouth shut for a while. We want to be nice to our southern people.
I think it's interesting too when you get a technical subject, like
yes,
a technical computer type stuff, there is no word to translate into that other language, so it's acknowledged and they'll just adopt the word in English just because there is no other word, so it becomes part of their lexicon just because there's nothing to match.
Oh, yeah. I never will forget the first day people kept talking about their mouse. I thought, man, I wouldn't brag about having a mouse in the house. And, of course, they were talking about something different. I didn't know what they were talking about. Yeah, language is a real challenge to us. Verse 2, now Saul chose for himself 3,000 men of Israel, of which 2,000 were with Saul in Michmash and the hill country of Bethel, while 1,000 were with Jonathan at Gibeah of Benjamin. But he sent away the rest of the people, each to his tent. Now, at this point, it may be a little difficult for you to understand this geographically, unless you have a good Bible map and you want to follow along. Let me just simply tell you that Gilgal, in the map of the Holy Land, is right close to the Jordan River, not very far away from Jericho. And when you go from Gilgal over to the Philistine area, you don't have to travel more than about 40, 43 miles to get to Philistine area. Now, the whole Israel at that particular point is only about 50-some miles across. We're talking about a small piece of geography here. It's almost like talking about some of our counties in our country when we're talking about the whole country there. So a lot of these places like Michmash and Gilgal and Gibeah and Geba, which is probably another name for Gibeah, and Bethel and Jerusalem, all these places are really fairly close together, just sometimes a mile, sometimes a few miles, but they're not all that far apart. So we're basically thinking about the middle part of the land of Israel, the promised land, just to the north of the Dead Sea. If you can visualize the Sea of Galilee up north and the Dead Sea at the south, just to the north of the Dead Sea, and then across over toward the Mediterranean. That's where all of this is taking place. Now, can the length of Saul's reign prior to calling the 3,000 men be determined? The answer is no, it can't. We're not given a detailed indication of the exact time period from one event to another event that's unfolding here in the story of 1 Samuel. Now, Michmash was located about 7 miles northeast of Jerusalem. That's not very far away. Some of you may have come further than that to get here tonight. Who was Jonathan? All right, he's the son of Saul. Now, this is the first time that he's mentioned. He's going to play a real important part here in a little bit. Now, why did Saul place his army in two different locations?
Strategy.
Yeah, strategy. He doesn't know exactly where the Philistines are going to make their attack. And he wants to be prepared if they're going to be in one area or another area. And so he is placing his men where they can be prepared to meet the challenge. Who were the rest of the people who were sent to their tents? All right. Yeah, I think so. These are the ones he's not needing at this particular time. This is confirming the fact that Paul now has organized what we would call his standing army. Everyone can be called to serve at one time, but there are certain people that have been set aside, and this is his setting aside of these particular people in these specific locations. Verse 3.
Jonathan smote the garrison of the Philistines that was in Geba, and the Philistines heard it. Then Saul blew the trumpet throughout the land, saying, "Let the Hebrews hear."
Now, what's a garrison?
Station of so many troops.
Yeah, it's where the enemy is camped. An outpost. Now, how much time lapsed between verses 2 and 3? We're not told. Probably a few months. But we don't really know for sure. Why would Saul have sent heralds throughout the land to sound the trumpet?
To let everybody know.
Internet. That's right. This is a word of warning. We need to gather together for the conflict that seems to be very imminent at this point. Now, what proclamation accompanied the sounding of the trumpet?
Let the Hebrews hear.
Yes. That would be a key phrase for what? Arm yourself. Get ready. We're going to be called to battle very soon. Verse 4, please.
All Israel heard the news that Saul had smitten the garrison of the Philistines, and also that Israel had become odious to the Philistines. The people were then summoned to Saul at Gibeah.
All right. What had Israel become to the Philistines? Like a bad stench, terrible odor. They didn't want to have a thing to do with them. Now, as a result of the trumpet blast and the proclamation, where did the people come together to join with Saul?
Gilgal.
Gilgal. Now, where is Gilgal?
North of Jericho.
Close to Jericho and to what river?
Jordan.
Jordan River, which would place it on the east side of the Holy Land. Now, why was Gilgal chosen as the meeting place? All right, this is where they have met before. This is where Saul was proclaimed as king. This is going to be about as far away as they can get from the Philistines so that they can rally the troops and make all their plans and arrangements to go out and meet them in conflict. This is where they got started when Joshua led them into the initial conquest of the land of Palestine. So everything seemed to point to this being a logical place for them to be. Now the Philistines assembled to fight with Israel, 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen, and people like the sand which is on the seashore in abundance, and they came up and camped in Michmash, east of Bethaven. Now, there is a problem in this verse in the New American Standard that I'm using tonight, and that is the 30,000 chariots. So, does that not sound like a lot of chariots for the number of horsemen that they had?
Yes.
Way out of proportion. It's more like 3,000. In the Hebrew language, the last letter of Israel, I'm talking about the Hebrew language now, is also the letter that is used to represent the number 3. And so some think that is just a copying mistake that was made here, but that it's more likely that there were 3,000 chariots with 2 men in each chariot. That would make a lot more sense.
Unless the horsemen were separate from the chariot. I mean, they would, the chariots would, the horsemen were separate. In any event, it's a big number.
Oh my.
Spear chariot, so that when one is broken down, they can put another one in the battle.
Okay.
My Bible says 3,000.
Sure. I'm glad you brought your Bible with you. It's establishing what I said earlier.
Yes.
There's going to be a difference in the versions. And I wanted to point that out. And we've had a couple of instances tonight where this has become an issue. But we ought not to be disturbed by this, folks. People do make mistakes. Now, what is meant by people like the sand which is on the seashore in abundance?
I guess it's numberless, that they can't count them. That's why they just said.
Yeah. You know, it's just like what is said concerning the seed of Abraham. Like the stars in the heavens, like the sand on the seashore. Just a way of saying, don't try to count them. There's just a whole bunch of them there. Big number. Did the Philistines assemble in an area where they could be seen by the Israelites?
Yes.
Michmash was not that far away from Gilgal. When the men of Israel saw that they were in a strait, for the people were hard pressed, then the people hid themselves in caves, in thickets, in cliffs, in cellars, and in pits. Some of the Hebrews crossed the Jordan into the land of Gad and Gilead, but as for Saul, he was still in Gilgal, and all the people following him trembling. Now, what's the meaning of being in a strait?
That they're incapable of getting out of the situation that they're in.
In a rock and a hard place.
Yes.
That's a good way to say it, rock and a hard place. They just felt hemmed in. They didn't know what direction to turn. Why did the Israelites hide themselves?
Because they were horrified.
They're overwhelmed with the Philistine force, the sheer numbers that are involved. So they're feeling a bit of fear here. Isn't that interesting? I thought the king was supposed to win all their battles for them. But all of a sudden, they're experiencing quite a bit of fear. What distinction may be noted between the men of Israel and the Hebrews? Well, obviously, I think he's trying to make a distinction here, the writer of 1 Samuel, between the two groups that have been described for us. One group mentioned in verse 6 that we just read would be those who excuse themselves from military service. And the other group would be those who had been selected by Saul in verse 2 to serve in Saul's standing army. What is the location of Gad and Gilead in reference to Jordan River?
On the other side.
That's right, on the east side of the Jordan River. Now, he waited 7 days according to the appointed time set by Samuel, but Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattering from him. Now, this is going to be quite interesting. Get the picture. They're waiting for Samuel to come, and the time had been set by Samuel. I'm going to be there in 7 days. But he did not come. And so the people were scattering. Now, had similar instructions been given to Samuel by Samuel to Saul previously? Yes, they had. Back in chapter 10 and verse 8, you may recall, said, as you go down before me, this is Samuel talking to Saul, as you go down before me to Gilgal, you wait there. I'm going to come down. And when I come down, I'm going to offer burnt offering and peace offerings to the Lord, but you're going to have to wait 7 days until I come. So this is another indication where he's indicated a specific number of days. We're not told why 7 days, but that's what he said. Now, is a reason given for Samuel's delay? No reason is mentioned in the scriptures. Would you read verse 9?
So Saul said, bring to me the burnt offering and the peace offering, and he offered the burnt offering.
All right, now, if you had not read ahead, and you just got this far, when you read verse 9, what would you have concluded by now?
He's given up on Samuel.
That's right. Now, what did, I think there's a typo in your questions, what did Saul do in an effort to keep the people from scattering from him? Went on and offered the offerings, didn't he? Instead of waiting for Samuel, as Samuel told him to do. Do you know what a burnt offering was? The burnt offering actually was an offering in which the entire part of it was burnt, the entire animal. And this would be, I think, symbolic probably, of their complete consecration to God. Was Saul functioning as a priest and offering the burnt offerings?
Yes, and he should.
Yeah, that's right. All right, would you read verse 10, please?
As soon as he finished offering the Behold, Samuel came, and Saul went out to meet him and greet him. 11?
No, just 10. That's fine. Did Samuel arrive on the appointed day? Yes, he did. Did Samuel arrive before the peace offerings were offered?
No.
Yes.
Apparently. Verses 11 and 12.
But Samuel said, "What have you done?" And Saul said, "Because I saw the people were scattering from me, and that you did not come within the appointed days, and that the Philistines were assembling at Michmash. Therefore I said, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not asked for the favor of the Lord. So I forced myself and offered the burnt offering."
I love that phrase, "so I forced myself."
Had to do it.
Had to do it, yeah. Is Samuel's question a rebuke?
Yes.
Surely is. How did Saul defend his actions?
Oh, he made up very slimy.
Weakly.
Yeah, rather ineffectively. Hey, the people were scattering. And you did not appear at the set time. Oh, wait a minute. I didn't say what time of the day. And the Philistines were assembling. And by the way, this is only about 10 miles away, so they could know about this. Was Saul more interested in the psychological impact that the sacrificial rituals would have on his troops,
yes,
than on pleasing God so as to win his favor?
Yes.
It appears that way. Was the defense of Saul inadequate?
Very much so.
Sure, God does not depend upon the number of people involved. True or false?
True.
True. Saul is not appreciating that fact. They need to recognize that in their own history, has God done some phenomenal things through just a small group of people?
Yes.
Certainly has. Certainly has. What is meant by, "I forced myself"?
He knew it was wrong, but he did it anyway.
Yeah. Couldn't help myself. Couldn't control myself.
Devil made me do it.
Very self-centered.
I didn't want to, but I had to. Yeah. You were here.
Yeah. Folks, this is serious. One of the characteristics of the fruit of the Spirit, which ought to describe the life of every Christian, is self-control. And how many times we have a habit, or we do something, or we say something and say, "Oops, it just came out. I couldn't help myself." Is God's Spirit unable to enable us to have self-control? Now, folks, when we say, "I couldn't help myself," what are we saying about our relationship with the Holy Spirit?
That we don't depend on.
We chose not to.
That's right. That's right. So, you know, this is another one of those lessons in the Old Testament, I think, that's so applicable, and it's easy for us to read over it and find it interesting. But how many times, probably, have we been guilty of the same thing in different areas of our life and different circumstances? Verses 13 through 15, please.
Samuel said to Saul, "Hear that you foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, as you commanded you. And now the Lord has established your kingdom as Israel. But now your kingdom shall not endure. The Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart, and has appointed him as ruler of his people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you." Then Samuel arose and went up from Gilgal to Gibeah of Benjamin, and Saul numbered the people who were present with him, about 600 men.
Did Samuel answer any of Saul's excuses for his actions?
Yeah, probably maybe foolish.
No, he didn't deal with them at all. He just skipped right over them.
Yeah, he did skip over them. In what four ways did Samuel rebuke the king? What's the first way? You acted foolishly, didn't he say that?
Yeah.
What's the second way?
You
didn't keep the commandment. Shame on you. What's the third thing that he says to him?
Your kingdom is
not going to last. And what's the fourth thing that he says? God's looking for a man after his own heart. These are the four things that are being said by way of rebuke to the king. In what way had Saul acted foolishly? He had not waited for Samuel. He had, and obviously, on this occasion, he would have to have waited 7 complete days. He was not willing to wait that long. Got a little bit impatient. Now, explain what is meant by a man after his own heart. Yeah, somebody that really appreciates what it means to have a right relationship with God, and who above all other desires wants to put God first in his life. Now, how many times did Samuel tell Saul that he had not obeyed the Lord's commandment? Once in verse 13 and again in verse 14. Did Saul take exception to the charge of Samuel regarding his disobedience? No, he doesn't take exception with it. He knows it's true. How many men did Saul have with him to confront the Philistines? 600 men. Now, he probably had a standing army of more men that he could have called in, but at least the scriptures mention on this occasion he had 600 men with him. Who did the Lord defeat at an earlier time with only 300 men? Midianites, as time during Gideon. All right, verse 16.
Now Saul and his son Jonathan and the people who were present with them were then in the people. Benjamin, while the Philistines camped at Mishmash.
All right, though we are not informed when this action took place, where did Saul go with his 600 men? To Geba. This is probably another name for Gibeah, in the territory of Benjamin. Now again, let me try to help you see where we are. Jerusalem was in the what tribe?
Judah.
Just immediately to the north of the tribe of Judah was the smaller area of Benjamin. So this is that area that I've talked to you about before tonight. Is Geba close to Michmash?
Yes.
Actually, it's less than a mile away. So it's really close. And the raiders came from the camp of the Philistines in 3 companies. One company turned toward Ophrah, to the land of Shuai. Another company turned toward Beth Horon. And another company turned toward the border which overlooks the valley of Zeboiim, toward the wilderness. What was the purpose of sending part of the Philistine army in 3 different directions? Again, it's strategy, like you'd said before tonight on another occasion. He's going to try to get the people of Israel all discombobulated.
They got a lot fewer people, and they'd have to spread out real thin trying to cover them.
How? That's right. All right. Verses 19 through 22, please.
Now, no blacksmith could be found in all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, otherwise the Hebrews will make swords or spears. So all Israel went down to the Philistines, each to sharpen his plowshare, his mattock, his axe, and his hoe. The charge was 2/3 of a shekel for the plowshares, the mattocks, the forks, and the axes, and to fix the hoe. So it came about on the day of the battle that neither sword nor spear was found in the hands of any of the people who were with Saul and Jonathan, but they were found with Saul and his son Jonathan.
All right, what are these verses telling us? They were not really very well prepared to face the Philistine threat, obviously. Is this a picture of the Israelite army lacking weapons of war? Yes, it is. Did the Philistines charge a high price for their services?
Yes.
They certainly did that. Verse 23.
And the garrison of the Philistines went out to the pass of Mishmash.
All right, what was the purpose of this maneuver?
To block the men.
They're hoping to cut off all the avenues of attack by the men of Saul and Jonathan. Now, how may this situation at this point be described?
Grief. Depends on which side you're on.
All right. Okay, between Geba and Michmash, there was a deep valley that ran down the plain toward of the Jordan. And the Philistines had pickets posted on the cliffs at the very edge of the valley. So they are really in a real tough place, geographically speaking, to make a surprise attack on the camp. And so this is setting the stage for a very heroic action taken by Jonathan, the son of Saul. And we're going to read about that in the next chapter. I think we'll stop here tonight because I'd like to cover chapter 14 all in one sitting, and we're just about through. Any further questions or comments over the passages that we looked at tonight? Father in heaven, thank you for your word, for the lessons it brings to our attention, for the importance of heeding your instruction, for the folly of trusting in ourselves, when in reality you are the only one who is all-powerful. May we recognize that what is taught in history can be applied to our present situation, as history is now in the making. May we look to you with great confidence as we endeavor, each one of us, to take a firm stand for truth and righteousness. May we be guided by your Spirit, and may your will be accomplished in our lives, that we might gain victory over the evil one who is intent upon destroying us. Equip us, encourage us, protect us. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.